This summer in North Texas, we've already logged so many afternoons over 100 degrees that a recent Saturday, when it only hit 94, felt positively refreshing. This much persistent heat feels abnormal, even for a place notorious for its steamy summers. But given that much of the Northern Hemisphere is broiling this season, maybe abnormally hot will be the new normal. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We know quite a bit about surviving the heat here. Stay hydrated, be careful about overexertion, head indoors to where it's air-conditioned during the hottest hours. But maybe we could be doing more to cool outdoor spaces. As my guest has learned, if that idea is not as far-fetched as it sounds, it's also not as easy as it sounds. Journalist Will Bostwick writes for Texas Monthly, where you can read his article, "This Texas Heat is Killing Us." Will, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So you could publish a story like this during any July in Texas and find an eager audience, but this year really does feel different. It's not just us feeling a normal, hotter than normal summer. There are extreme temperatures throughout the Northern Hemisphere, North America, Asia, Europe, Africa. It's hard not to be alarmed about this right now.
Right. Yeah. And you know, last summer felt like an unusually hot summer. And I think, in fact, it was. It was the second hottest one on record in Texas. And so, yeah, like you alluded to in your introduction, I think this is becoming a new normal. And certainly it's hitting home with these sort of especially hot temperatures early in the summer this year.
Lots of the talk around climate change focuses on rising sea levels, which are a problem, but extreme heat can be deadly, especially for medically vulnerable people. How is it that our bodies can cope with heat, like up to a certain point, until they catastrophically fail?
Yeah, right. Our bodies are really well adapted, right, to deal with heat. We do things like sweat, and vasodilate, and that served us well for a really long time. But you're right. Once we hit this kind of tipping point where our internal body temperature reaches a certain level, then it becomes dangerous, and you know, shortly after that, it can become fatal. Our body is sort of a fine-tuned instrument, and once we hit these thresholds, it can be quite dangerous.
So you mentioned we set some heat records last summer. What do we know about how those temperatures might have contributed to what are called excess deaths in Texas?
Right. So last summer in Texas, we saw 279 heat-related deaths. And that's according to reporting from the Texas Tribune, who was analyzing state data. And that was a two-decade high for heat-related deaths in the state. The other thing is it's almost certainly an undercount, right? It's hard to attribute, it's hard to classify a death as heat-related because it really has to be a well-documented heat stroke. As we know, heat can contribute to so many other things.
Broadly speaking, do we know who were those people killed by these inescapable high temperatures, who they were likely to be?
To some extent, we do. Sadly, but not surprisingly, heat tends to prey on the most vulnerable. So in that reporting by the Texas Tribune, there was, they attribute it broadly to two categories, people experiencing homelessness and migrants crossing the border. I think there was a lot of evidence to suggest that both of those groups bore the brunt of this burden. Certainly that it was not exclusive to them. You know, heat can really get anybody in the right circumstances.
Beyond even acute heat-related illnesses, there's evidence that repeated exposure to high temperatures can take a toll on our health. What do you know about how that can play out for people?
Yeah, so I talked with Dr. Elizabeth Matsui, who's the director of the Center for Health and Environment at the University of Texas Dell Medical School. And she explained there's a handful of effects that heat can have on your body. And it's, of course, you know, there's these tragic sudden heat strokes that are often fatal. But then, you know, there's what she called a sort of spectrum of direct effects that follow that. And you know, we know just recently the journal Nature published a piece that showed that even moderate heat can strain the heart. We know that heat can strain the respiratory system and the kidneys. Matsui noted that pregnant women in particular are susceptible to heat illness, and heat can put them at further risk of high blood pressure and premature labor, which of course can lead to severe birth defects. And then, you know, it keeps going from there, right? I could keep going. For instance, you know, that there's correlations between heat and an increase in violent crime. And in fact, heat can have an effect on our mental health, as you know, anecdotally, many Texans could probably attest to.
Yeah, years ago when I was a reporter and covering, you know, kind of crime and horrible stuff that happened, the police would always talk about, oh, it's going to be really hot today. We're kind of on guard. Do we know? I mean, does heat simply just make people very irritable, or do psychiatrists now think there are like other brain effects of heat exposure?
Right. I mean, yeah, Matsui noted that particularly when you're experiencing extreme heat and symptoms of heat illness, it quickly acts upon your brain, upon your decision making. I don't know, you know, sort of the full breadth of what sort of psychological research shows us about this, but it's been well documented, yeah, that it can both affect sort of our mental health and our decision making. And you know, again, anecdotally, that as someone who tries to get out and run during the summer, you know, that makes sense, that checks out, but there is actually some evidence to support that.
Well, that's an interesting, I'm glad you brought that up, because there's like a knock-on effect of very hot weather, which is that it becomes dangerous to work out outdoors for most of the day, right? You can get up super early or maybe do it late at night, but over time, if many people find it more challenging to exercise for months on end, that is going to make many of us less healthy.
Right, and that was sort of the area of expertise of a second health expert I talked to, a guy named Kevin Lanza, who works at UT Health Houston School of Public Health. And he told me that his sort of area of focus was the impact that climate change and increased heat can have on sort of these everyday lifestyle things. For instance, exercising. We know exercise is vitally important to maintaining good health, and heat certainly disincentivizes that. And I mean, you could expand it to look at a number of different things. I mean, you know, children need to be getting outside. There's a lot of evidence to show that simply being outdoors and exercising outdoors is good for your health, and that's hard to do when it's really hot and you don't have adequate shade. But yeah, there are some interventions that sort of allow us to do that even on hot days.
Before we move on from this, like, no one listening needs convincing that lots of heat can be dangerous and really unpleasant. But here in North Texas, Will, we almost inevitably get these air quality alerts on the hottest days, which is to say, telling us the air quality is not good. Why does breathing become more difficult for many people when it's very hot outside?
Yeah, I mean, I heat strains the body's systems, right? And so it makes all of these sort of everyday functions that we don't think about harder, right? Just because the system is trying to keep up. So the respiratory system is included in that. And sort of broadly speaking, the respiratory system is under strain when it is quite hot outside. So that makes it harder to breathe.
If there is any benefit to being a Texan as the weather gets hotter absolutely everywhere, it's that you know, we have a lot of experience taking care of ourselves when it is dangerously hot out. But historically, those solutions have been about staying indoors in the shade as much as possible. How did the idea begin to emerge that we ought to start looking at ways to keep outdoor spaces cooler?
Yeah, you know, it's a relatively, it's new and it's old, right? I mean, as long, yeah, one of the, when I started looking into this, one of the researchers referred to trees as a sun blocking intervention, which is funny, you know, thinking of trees in these sort of research terms, when as long as creatures have been walking the earth, I suspect they've been seeking solace in the shade. So that's and it's still one of the best options we have. But yeah, there are these slightly more high-tech interventions that are emerging. And they started in cities like Phoenix and Los Angeles. And one of the most prominent examples of this is cool pavement. So it's basically just a reflective sealant that's applied to asphalt. And it's not terribly high-tech, though it has been shown to be useful in certain situations.
So what does cool pavement look like when it's applied to a paved surface?
It kind of looks like gray paint. I actually went to San Antonio where watched some crews apply this cool pavement to a city street. And it looks like a thin liquid paint or something like a concrete, nothing that would look terribly out of the ordinary, but it does in some instances have some of these sort of beneficial effects.
So is this typically applied like to roadway surfaces or sidewalks?
It would usually be applied to roadways. That's how it's been used most widely in these cities like Phoenix and Los Angeles and then San Antonio, where I saw it being applied. It would be to the city streets rather than the sidewalks. And it could also be applied to, to a parking lot, something that's basically the same consistency as an asphalt street.
Boy, anyone who's been in the middle of an unshaded parking lot, you know, in a Texas summer knows what a difference that could potentially make.
Well, yeah, and it's tricky. It's really tricky because, as I suspect you will get into, there are some downsides to this that researchers have found. And in fact, one of those downsides is that when you're standing above it in the hottest point of the day, it can actually feel hotter, even though the surface temperature is cooler. So for instance, I visited a site that had been completed in San Antonio, and I was walking down the street, and I didn't have a infrared thermometer with me, so I couldn't tell you that I don't have the numbers to back it up, but just walking down the street in the middle of the day, it felt hotter because you could feel that sun radiating off the asphalt when ordinarily much of it would be absorbed by the asphalt. But I mentioned in the piece, I actually bent down and touched the street, and it felt cooler. So it was doing its job, but in doing its job, it does radiate that heat or that feeling of heat up.
I guess in the same way that standing behind a reflector of some kind, you might feel cooler, but standing in front of that reflector, having the heat reflected on you makes you warmer. The same thing might happen with a cool pavement. The surface feels okay. You might be able to walk on it barefoot, but inches or feet above it, the air feels warmer.
Yeah, right. And it makes sense, right? I mean, it like you explained with that great example, but it's a sort of unfortunate side effect. We reduce the surface temperature, but the experience of, say, a pedestrian walking on such a surface, their experience of that could be hotter. But yeah, you've got it exactly right.
Some people think there still may be benefits, though, because, of course, if the asphalt all throughout the hottest parts of the day is absorbing heat, that heat is going to be released and keep the surrounding area warmer through the night, even though the air is cooler.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that phenomenon called the urban heat island effect, where cities are hotter than their rural surroundings. That's explained in large part because there is so much so many paved surfaces, so many buildings that are absorbing this heat during the day, and even at night, letting it off, keeping the temperatures fairly high. Another possible application for this would just be in areas where you don't see a lot of pedestrians, maybe arterial roads, where you don't have crosswalks, for instance. And so that's one of the things that these researchers are looking at. And there may be even, you know, more sort of nuanced and fine-tuned ways to apply this in a useful way. But it is complicated.
So you mentioned his name briefly already, but you introduce us in this article to Kevin Lanza, who is a professor at UT Health Houston School of Public Health. How did Kevin Lanza get interested in the potential for creating cooler outdoor environments in Texas?
Yeah, Kevin told me that he grew up in Florida and that he's a runner. He was a collegiate runner and always enjoyed being outdoors. So certainly, if you're of a certain age and you're a geographer, climate change has to become a focus. So I think as sort of his interests aligned, his primary interest became sort of how do we continue to allow healthy activity outdoors as the Earth is warming.
So he was part of this study actually in Dallas back in 2017 that concluded some areas of this same city were fully 15 degrees cooler than others, or hotter than others, however you want to say it. What did the cooler places have going for them that the hotter ones did not?
Yeah, I mean, in general, it's the thing, some of the things we've already talked about. So if you've got a lot of shade, that goes a long way, right? It is much cooler in the shade, as everyone knows. And there are whole neighborhoods that have tree canopies. And then there are neighborhoods that don't. It also just having these buildings or paved surfaces can increase the heat burden in these parts of the city. So yeah, that study that Lanza worked on found that if they applied these sort of heat mitigation measures, you could receive, you know, 15 degrees of cooling in some areas of the city on hot summer days. So that is, I mean, as we all know, that's a significant amount of cooling.
So cool pavement technologies, this is one of these strategies. I know that there are different like formulas of preparation for cool pavement sealants, but in general, the idea is that by making the surface a lighter color, you gain all the benefits of light surfaces that we know about. This is why we wear light colored clothing in the summertime. Is that right?
Yeah, right. And I think there it's probably even more slightly more complex than that, right? That there are these sort of reflective chemicals in the sealant itself. It's not simply the color, though. I think you're exactly right that is a factor. But basically, yeah, we make it a reflective surface, so it's not absorbing the heat in the way that you know a black T-shirt might absorb the heat when a white T-shirt doesn't.
So, do these surface treatments affect the way the road functions? Do they make it more slippery?
Well, that's something that these researchers are looking at. So, they're in San Antonio, for instance, there are kind of two teams of researchers. Some are looking at the sort of climatic factors that we've discussed. Others are looking at more of the functional factors. You know, does it make it harder to drive on the surface? Is it more slippery? Is the glare a problem? These are all things that they're looking at, and that's why they've done it in sort of different areas. In a diversity of areas and you know, haven't just, you know, whole scale applied it to the whole city yet, because they need to see how it works, both functionally and in terms of reducing temperatures.
So you mentioned that you rode along with a crew in San Antonio that was applying this treatment to like a half mile section of a residential street, before the treatment, what was the difference in temperature between just, you know, black asphalt in direct sunlight and a shaded section of sidewalk nearby?
Yeah, it was funny. I was with the city of San Antonio's chief sustainability officer, a guy named Douglas Melnick, and he brought with him, you know, not necessarily as part of the research, just out of curiosity, he brought this sort of pistol-shaped infrared thermometer, and he was as we were talking, he was sort of taking different surface temperature readings, and the sunny asphalt, at one of the points he was taking a reading, the sunny asphalt early in the morning registered about 86 degrees already on this May morning. And then he took the temperature of a nearby sidewalk that was in the shade, and that was 71. So you know, you've got a 15 degree temperature difference just there.
How, if there are five different formulations being tested in San Antonio, how will their effectiveness be assessed? Like, what are the evaluators looking for?
Yes. So, yeah, as I mentioned, they're looking at these sort of two broad categories, which one is, how does it perform as a roadway? Because, you know, it's gotta do that first. The second is how is the temperature change? So there's a researcher named Neil Debbidge who is leading sort of that climate focused aspect of the study. And he told me that they're going to be looking at the wet bulb globe temperature, which is, it's one of these sort of human comfort readings that you would find, if you're trying to determine whether it's safe to hold a football practice on a hot afternoon, that you're often looking at the wet bulb globe temperature, which takes into consideration things like humidity, wind speed, sunlight, things like that. That's more complicated, obviously, than simply air temperature. So they're going to be taking a number of temperature readings like that to get an understanding of both sort of the actual air temperature, the actual surface temperature, and kind of the experience of a human walking on those surfaces.
So Texas cities are not the first to experiment with this technology. What sort of data were generated by studies of cool pavement installations in Phoenix and Los Angeles?
Yeah, so Phoenix and Los Angeles were kind of the forerunners on this, and they did fairly extensive studies in both of those cities. And in Phoenix, I think in both cities, it was, you know, partnered with the city itself, though they had independent researchers from universities nearby. So they found some of these same effects that we've discussed, right? That there are benefits at certain points of the day and in certain contexts, but that there are potential downsides. It's got to be applied sort of in a smart way, knowing sort of all of these factors.
Presumably, people in Phoenix and LA pretty much never have to worry about winter temperatures being really cold and roads icing. San Antonio's a little less susceptible than Dallas, but I'm thinking here we have incredibly hot pavement in the summer and then we have these ice storms in the winter. Do cool pavements cause ice storms to be worse potentially?
Yeah. I mean, these are all questions that they're trying to answer in this study in San Antonio. I mean, I asked one of the LA researchers if you could expect, you know, basically exactly the same results in San Antonio. And she said, no, I mean, you know, it's a different climate. It could be different. We know sort of the general trends are probably going to apply, but yeah, I mean, one of the things I repeatedly found as I was doing this is this is unknown territory, and it's not terribly complex as we've discussed, but it's but we're just beginning to learn how do we adapt to this heat, and so even the fairly simple technologies, they're going to require a lot of research and a lot of data collection, including just like you're talking about, figuring out does something that works in some contexts in Phoenix will it work in San Antonio? I don't think we know for sure.
Let's just say a city decided this worked for it. How expensive would it be to like cover every road surface within an urban area?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have the numbers for, you know, what it would cost to, for instance, cover every surface in San Antonio, but it is a relatively cheap intervention as far as these things go. I believe the San Antonio project itself, the one we're talking about where they applied this product to 10 different sections, I think the number was like, it was about $1 million. So it's a relatively inexpensive for a project of this scale. I mean, of course, any big project costs money, but I think Cool Pavement is seen as a relatively inexpensive intervention.
To go back, Will, to the urban heat island effect, besides the sun bearing down on, you know, pavement surfaces, what are some other things that produce heat in an urban area? Like, why would a densely populated place be hotter than a less populated place?
Yeah, I mean, most of it has to do with development, right? So we've talked about sort of concrete and asphalt. You know, they're going to absorb that temperature in a way that maybe a rural area would not. Sun is going to reflect off of this pavement and asphalt in a way that it doesn't off of say a grassy hillside. But also, you know, in developing a city, you're knocking down trees. And trees provide cooling both through their shade, but also through this process called transpiration, which is basically evaporative cooling. So any kind of development often brings with it this sort of urban heat island effect, where heat can get trapped in the city.
One finding in studies of the disparity of, you know, heat in the same city from neighborhood to neighborhood seems to consistently be that lower income areas are hotter than wealthier areas. Is that just because wealthier areas have more trees typically?
That's certainly a big factor. You know, it's not, you can find lower income neighborhoods that have great tree canopies. But yeah, I mean, as you know, if you've ever looked for a house or a rental property, you know, even if you're not even really thinking about it, trees and shade are a selling point, right? Because it makes the space cooler, but B, because they, you know, they look nice and it's as simple as that. But right, yeah. So it does follow these trends where low-income neighborhoods are often found to be significantly hotter. And it's the absence of trees, but it's also, you know, more pavement, more industrialization, and less shade.
Lots of lawmakers these days are, you know, compelled to at least address inequality in the speeches they give and the plans they make. Are you starting to hear politicians talk about heat inequality in some form as they talk about, you know, policies that the state or local areas might need?
Certainly, I've heard local city officials address this. In San Antonio, for instance, Douglas Melnick, the chief sustainability officer, you know, repeatedly brought up to me, you know, we need to be doing this. We need to be applying these measures in sort of an equitable way because the heat disproportionately affects certain groups. I'm not seeing it as much among state leaders in Texas. You know, there may be some out there, but yeah, I haven't yet seen it at that level. Hopefully, it will sort of filter up. Because certainly it seems to be a serious concern, serious and growing.
It's worth noting that the Texas legislature just ended this rule that construction workers would be required to get a water break every 4 hours. Are there people advocating for these folks whose jobs require them to be outside in the heat all day?
Yeah, there certainly are people advocating for them. And yeah, that bill that you alluded to that reduced cities' powers to enforce water breaks, for instance. That's something that people brought up to me a lot. It seems to show, you know, an inability to reckon with this very serious threat. Of course, that was part of a very big bill that aimed to do a lot of different things. But yeah, that one of the severe consequences is that cities lost that ability to require these water breaks, and that's been a major issue among lots of folks that I've talked with.
We should talk here, Will, about the Texas Trees Foundation, this group that's been active since the early 80s. What is the mission of the Texas Trees Foundation?
Well, yeah, it's a really interesting organization, and it's kind of the mission has kind of evolved over time. I think it started, like you mentioned, in the early 80s as kind of a complement to Dallas's Parks Department, just trying to sort of provide assistance where it could as a foundation. But it has developed significantly since then. They've planted thousands of trees throughout North Texas and are reaching, you know, areas beyond North Texas. They've got some projects in Midland and Corpus, I believe. And plans, I think, to extend further beyond that. So that's planting trees has been a big part of what they've done historically, though they are also looking at even more sort of complex, high tech and nuanced solutions. And they have their eyes attuned to heat. And that's something that they're trying to address with some of their big ambitious new projects.
Have they been able to demonstrate with research that, say, the trees they've planted have had any effect on health in this part of the state?
Yeah. So how trees affect health is a bit hard to quantify, right? Though, of course, you can show that as Texas Trees has done, and in fact, they commissioned this study that Kevin Lanza worked on that we talked about earlier in the show. And they were able to show, like we discussed, that certain parts of the city were much hotter than other parts. And it allowed them to sort of see how this breaks down on sort of a micro level. But as far as the sort of health benefits you've discussed, it is really hard to sort of quantify this tree saved this many lives, for instance. But there was and I mentioned this in the piece, that there was a study in 2014 that was done by U.S. Forest Service researchers, and they found that the U.S. saved more than 850 lives and $6.8 billion but by planting trees. Trees in the U.S. provided those benefits. Certainly you can quantify this, and it's a big number if you do.
Tell us about this project that Texas Trees is doing or has been doing in the Dallas Medical District around Parkland and the other hospitals that are nearby.
Yeah, so that study that we've discussed found that the Dallas Medical District was one of the hottest parts of the city. And I think immediately right there, that struck a lot of folks as a problem, right? I mean, this is where people are going to improve their health. Often people that are sort of chronically in hospitals are people that are suffering from a number of issues, and they don't need this sort of added burden of a really difficult environment, you know, particularly in the middle of the summer, a really difficult environment to navigate. And so what they've tried to do is cool the medical district, and it's a really ambitious project. They've enlisted design the design firm who designed New York City's High Line. They want to be able to, they've developed this project so that they can demonstrably cool certain parts of the city. And they focused on the medical district because it is a particularly hot region. And so one of the things that they're hoping to do, and plans are in place to do it, is reduce the number of lanes on Harry Hines Boulevard. And in fact, turn an elevated roadway near Harry Hines into a 10-acre park. So it's a really big project, and they're sort of collecting data in real time to make sure these things that they hope will cool the area are in fact cooling the area. So there's a lot going into it, a lot of moving parts, and they're still in the early design phase. But you know, if they complete it as intended, it could be a sort of a significant example of how to design around heat.
Many people by now may have heard of this technology called cool roofs, which I think is not so different from coating asphalt with a reflective surface. Do cool roofs, are they thought to keep an entire area a little bit cooler? Or are they really about reducing the sort of cooling bills and electrical load required in summer from a building somewhere?
Yeah, so it's a little bit of both, right? So one, you know, certainly if you've got a cool roof, which as you said is something like a reflective roof, and you could do it in a number of different ways. There are different technologies, but yeah, it could reduce your energy bill and keep your own home cooler. But if we did this on a large scale, you know, in the same way that if you did cool pavement on a large scale, it could have an effect across the city. And so that's, I think that's one of the tools in the tool bag that cities are looking at, sort of incentivizing these cool roofs as they might also apply some of the cool pavements.
To go back to trees and the role that they might play in keeping cities cooler and more pleasant in the hottest months, I mean, the big advantage, right, is that it's pretty cheap to plant a tree and grow it. Then again, it is not a quick fix solution. Are people talking about tree species that grow more quickly than others so that we can see results before, you know, 30 years from now?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I asked Texas Trees about this, about specific species, and they say, yeah, I mean, it really just depends on the area. So it gets even more complicated than how quickly they grow. You know, if you're talking about a tree that's right next to a roadway, you maybe don't want a tree that extends out horizontally quite a bit. You might want a tree that tends to grow straight up. Yeah, there are a lot of factors, you know, and you're right that yeah, planting trees is going to be a long-term investment. Though, you know, if you're talking about providing shade to a pedestrian, it could be slightly shorter term. You know, it would take, you know, maybe a decade rather than a number of decades. But yeah, and I think that's kind of the nature of any of these sort of climate mitigation techniques is they're going to have to be, at least many of them are going to have to be long-term investments. And we need to be thinking sort of 10, 20, 30 years into the future.
I'll confess, Will, I mean, we've been fortunate thus far this summer. I worry about the grid when it's really hot across the state. I mean, we use a lot of energy in Texas in the hottest days of summer, and it feels like we've just not had a break this year.
Yeah, you and me both, Chris. That is certainly a concern. I think it's a concern among people who really look at this stuff closely. We've been lucky. You know, the nightmare scenario I can imagine it doesn't seem too far-fetched, is that the grid goes out on some large scale as it did in February of 2021, and that happens on a really hot day, and I can imagine that there could be really significant health impacts. Of course, there were during the freeze, but it's not hard to imagine that it would be even more severe in the heat.
So, what do you know about the effectiveness of these places called cooling centers? Are they places that people are willing to go? And how close do you have to live to one to make it feasible to go cool off there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a thing that cities are still trying to deal with. I mean, among the researchers I talked to, particularly if you're talking about something like severe heat stroke and death, I mean, you've got to have these centers, right? I mean, you've got to have this dramatic. You can't just go sit in the shade if a heat stroke is coming on. You've got to have a dramatic temperature difference. And so I think these cooling centers are essential. But yeah, I have heard from cities that sometimes they aren't as popular as they would like them. They're not getting the attendance they would like to see on these hot summer days. So I think, you know, that's going to be a matter of sort of cities working out how do they advertise these best. I don't think it's a hard sell if you don't have another option to go to a place that's got air conditioning and bottled water. It would be pretty easy to convince me to do that, I think, if I were in that situation.
I think we're all hoping that, you know, these past couple of years maybe reflect a trend, but are an aberration in just how hot it's been. But, you know, you hear reports of like the Acropolis closing because the workers recognized that it wasn't safe to be working out in the heat. I mean, we could be looking at summer as a time when people don't travel, don't feel like it's safe to visit national parks. I mean, we could be looking at a very different future here.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's, you know, it's easy to really sort of let your mind sort of spin out of control when you think about this. Maybe these have been sort of aberrant summers, these last couple of summers, but probably they're just part of a trend in that direction. So we certainly need to be thinking about what we can do. Of course, you know, one of the things we've talked about is sort of how do you physically cool a city? A whole other aspect of this that cities like San Antonio are looking at is, you know, how do they contribute to a global reduction in emissions? Because that's the only thing that's going to affect climate change on a large scale. And you know, that's also something that's not really what this piece was about, but that's something that they're investing in also. And you would have to try to mitigate the worst possible outcomes.
Right. I mean, that's another stark irony that, you know, currently when it's incredibly hot, our go-to solution is air conditioning, which uses a whole lot of electricity.
Yeah. I think it's really, you find a lot of these sort of stark ironies when you look too closely at any of this stuff. And you know, again, there's Texas has tremendous potential when it comes to renewable energy. Again, I think state lawmakers are sort of standing in the way of some of that potential. But nonetheless, we're churning out tons of solar energy and wind energy. So those are both sort of those are good signs, I think, for the state. There is this sort of piling on effect when you look at any of these sort of severe threats.
So cities always have limited resources. It's going to be really important that if they decide to continue investing in these sort of outdoor temperature mitigation strategies, that they actually work. Are researchers getting better at measuring how well things like cool roofs and cool pavements and trees and anything else might work to keep a city a little bit cooler?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think the measurement itself is not terribly complicated. Like, I think the researchers are doing they know how to take these measurements. The problem is these mitigation measures such as cool pavements and cool roofing haven't been applied on the sort of wide scale that would be required to have the significant impact. We have to continue to sort of experiment with it. We have to look at whole sections of cities that have these measures in place if they show promise in these early studies, because it really would have to be sort of at least area wide application to see the kind of benefits that make the investment worth it.
Just briefly, you mentioned earlier that you're a runner. How have you adjusted your life to cope with many hours of the day when it is simply not safe to run?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a runner and not like a particularly great morning person, which are bad factors in the summer in Texas. So yeah, for me, it's go right before sundown, which is to me kind of the most pleasant time of day. You've got less direct sunlight and you tend to have more shade. But yeah, I mean, it's it's brutal. And I actually, yeah, I mean, there were a lot of people I talked to as I was reporting this piece that were like, hey, I skipped my regularly scheduled exercise today for just this reason that we're discussing. So I think that's probably fairly common.
Will Bostwick is a journalist who writes for Texas Monthly, where you can read his article, This Texas Heat is Killing Us. Will, thanks so much for making time to talk.
Thank you so much, Chris. It was fun to talk to you.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram and subscribe to the podcast wherever you get podcasts, or catch up on episodes right at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.